Let Sing and Swing.
Evening visit with Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt.
2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon in Manila.
And now we bring you Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowther, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines. Episode 16, Social Studies. Previously on Forbidden Diary.
The Japanese gave the General Committee permission to write a camp judicial code. Now, a dentist is taking over the camp's new judicial branches.
Oh, hi, Peg. Come have some coffee with us.
Thanks.
Any word from Davao about your husband?
No. You know, Jerry, we were separated when the war broke out.
I'm so confused, Miss McKim. So who's taking over for Mr. Hayakawa?
It's not Sergeant Fukihara. I think it's going to be a Lieutenant Kida.
And now, Episode 16.
May 10, 1943. As the new internees settle into camp, we hear more and more stories. Some I will never be able to erase from my mind, especially the ones from Marge and Bill Moole, and a newcomer named Foster.
I don't know, Natalie. For me, it was when the Japanese hit Apari a week after the first bomb. Man, I knew I had to get Marge and the kids away from the mine.
I didn't want to go. We were already living up in the boonies at Itogon Mine with other engineers' families, and Lusad Lumber Mill is even farther up in the mountains.
Yeah, about 4,000 feet straight up from Itogon Mine. But, you know, there were 80 cases of chow there, and I figured Japanese wouldn't bother us that far out.
Another family lived there, and they had a telephone and an aerial tram to get supplies up and down the mountain, and I was 8 months pregnant.
I hired 10 of the huskiest men from the Igorot Police Force to carry Marge up in a wicker chair strapped to 2 poles.
I looked ridiculous.
When the trail got too narrow, they put her in a blanket. I gotta tell you, when the Igorots hike, they go in a straight line up the mountain.
Weren't you worried about giving birth so far away from a hospital?
Oh no, my first two were easy deliveries.
Not everyone did what we did. When the Japanese started to invade, some people at the mine decided to hand themselves in at Brent School.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's reactions and choices were so different. We went to Brent.
Boy, I sure remember those days. Remember how fast they closed the road to Manila?
Oh, I sure do. When the Japanese invaded, the mining families who couldn't decide what to do had to go up to Lusad Mill because they couldn't get to Baguio or Manila.
Two of the gals were pregnant, one with her first baby.
Boy, they were brave.
Well, we really thought it'd just be a few months and figured we could rough it for a little bit.
That's what everyone thought. Boy, things sure got dicey when the army ordered us miners to burn all of our oil and blast bridges to get rid of the dynamite.
They burned all the gas at my station, too.
Did they?
Yeah. Natalie and I watched it from a lookout point above town.
Well, then the Filipino soldiers up and left, and the American soldiers went to Bataan.
But some American officers stayed behind. I don't think the army knew what they were doing. Aren't they supposed to have a plan or something?
All military plans fall apart at first contact with the enemy.
Well, that's a fact. So, after that happened, I made I don't know how many trips up and down that god-awful trail up to Lusad Mill, buttoning things up at the mine and getting supplies for us. On one trip, I'm huffing and puffing up the mountain and look over the side and see a pile of army trucks and cars dumped down the bottom of a canyon. But, you know, even then, I still thought, the U.S. is going to bail us out at any moment. It's crazy, huh?
You weren't the only one.
Well, it turned out, Lusad Mill wasn't safe. So everyone packed up and hiked to Manila.
Well, or tried to.
Yeah, we hiked about, I don't know, 60 miles to find out Manila wasn't safe and had to turn around.
And then spent the rest of the time trying to stay one step ahead of the Japanese. Wouldn't you say, Bill?
Yep.
Tell him about the village.
The Igorot Burial?
Yeah.
Ooh, how could I forget?
I still feel guilty.
What happened?
Well, while we were on the run from the Japanese, a village took us in.
No, more than that. They gave us their... Well, you tell it, Bill.
Okay. So, after saying our howdy-do's and thank-yous, we settled in and dropped off to sleep in one of their houses. The next morning, dead silence.
The entire village had left. I mean everyone.
I don't even think the dogs stuck around. Then it dawned on us. They couldn't risk helping Americans, and they didn't want to refuse us, so they just left their village.
Well, of course we left immediately.
And prayed that the Japanese would never find out we'd been there.
They could have easily turned us away.
Every one of those villagers risked their lives for us.
Bill and Marge are right. They really did risk their lives. Some Igorots gave me food, and their entire village was killed for it, to set an example. 80 men, women, and children were just slaughtered.
God, Foster, we've heard stories, but...
How could anyone do that?
I turned myself in when I heard about it. I didn't want any more blood on my hands.
You can't think of it that way. Those people's blood is on the hands of their murderers.
I really wish I could, but I can't. Well, then the Japanese tossed me in jail for 15 days. They gave us plenty of rice, and you could buy almost anything if you had the money. But they teased us with the water. When they turned it on, everyone stampeded to a water pipe sticking out of the wall, and then they just shut it off. If you couldn't get to the water in time, too bad for you. But the worst part was we never knew when they were going to turn it back on. So everyone watched that old pipe like the RCA Victor dog.
Jim's dad is in jail in Baguio and only gets one cup of water to drink and bathe with.
Yeah, poor guy. They let Filipinos look in the windows when we were being interrogated. This one Japanese captain yelled and jumped around, put on a real show. But after a while, the whole thing became as degrading for the interrogators as the prisoners. At least for the ones who weren't sadists. Man, I never thought human beings could behave in the ways I've seen. It's been a real education.
May 20, 1943. Well, now that the dysentery epidemic and the dry weather seems to be behind us, Camp Holmes has turned its attention to barracks improvements, shoe manufacture, and souvenirs. The talk, hammer, and pound in the barracks is all about suspended beds from the ceiling. There are 17 in this dorm, which now resembles a Pullman car with uppers and lowers. Because children's feet and the holes in our shoes are growing, the shop has over 50 orders for wooden clogs that are arranged on shelves in all stages of carving, down to a big log measured off in sections. As personal food supplies diminish, people are making and selling souvenirs to buy food from the camp store and elsewhere. Daphne is selling her campsite sketches for 75 cents each.
May 25th, 1943. I slept after lunch, but still feel a great lack of energy. I wish we could have eggs more often, but our cash must be stretched. Rice flour is getting scarce and skyrocketing in price. They've started food rationing in Baguio.
May 27, 1943. Our 18th month starts today, leaving us to wonder if it'll go on into 2 years. Howl at the thought of being stuck here another 6 months with some of these people. Camp Holmes is a petri dish of human behavior. Mrs. Coulter, who often blows her top, was at it this morning from one end of the backyard to the other.
She'd been on the receiving end of the camp judicial code for disregarding the new dorm rules. And because doctors make up the general committee who create and enforce the code, she broadcast a long gamut of opinion about the hospital staff, their freedom, their parties, and privileges. And next, the tirade turned to commingling inequities when she blurted out her most classic line to date.
We were only doing what every respectable, happily married couple does.
Which points to the absurdities and contradictions in our situation. These days, commingling freedom has gone to the unmarried, or those without mates at hand. Well, there was enough truth in her diatribe to make it difficult to combat, and gave the camp some quiet public chuckles and a lot of laughs in the women's barracks. How could you have missed it?
Mrs. Coulter is on a crusade for sex.
That old trout?
Well, bless her heart.
She does have a point, you know. If my husband were here, I'd be upset about all of these stupid commingling rules.
Mrs. Coulter must have been talking with Eric and his wife.
How's that?
A guard came up to them at lunch and asked if they were married. When they said yes, he said they could eat together, but not sleep and make a baby, because if the soldiers can't do it, no one can.
Typical male logic.
Ah, but the Japanese soldier can and does.
Why, Miss McKim.
Oh, don't be so surprised. I hear all sorts of things from the guards. A few weeks ago, Sergeant Fukihara told me that he thinks America's going to win the war and retake the Philippines.
Did you ask him when this is going to happen? Because I'd sure like to know.
No, he said that the reason is we have more planes. But when I asked him if Japan couldn't make planes too, he said, not as fast as America.
Oh, looks like everyone in this camp's an armchair strategist. Even the guards.
But get this. Sergeant Fukihara looked me straight in the eye and said that in the meantime, Dr. Dean can make the sick well and the rest of our men could play softball.
Just like one big happy family.
He says it's very boring taking care of us. And the guards welcome events of any kind. Even infractions by us, so they have something to do.
Well, we're like that too, aren't we? So bored we'll chew any rumor to pieces.
Well, then here's a really good one for you. I heard another woman has been snooping around the hospital and ratting on husbands and wives, and husbands not with their wives.
Oh my, I haven't heard that. I mean about the cheating.
Mm-hmm. She's refusing to obey commingling rules because the general committee chairman, hospital staff, and baby house are exempt.
The baby house?
It has two rooms where couples can go and shut the doors.
You know, I don't think this is really any of our business.
Why, Miss McKim, you're blushing.
Oh, I am not.
Peg, weren't you going to tell us about your visitor?
Oh my gosh, I almost forgot about Mr. Matsumoto.
Who's he?
A business friend of my husband's. He's the head of a plantation in Davao. I still can't believe he came all the way to tell me about Walter.
Your husband?
Yes, we were separated early in the war.
That's been over a year and a half.
Yes. It's been just me and our three little hooligans.
I don't know how you mothers do it all by yourselves.
Me neither. When the war broke out, we were all interned at a funeral parlor. Did I ever tell you that, Natalie?
No.
That pail I used to wash clothes came from there. Walter salvaged it and cleaned out the embalming wax. Anyway, Mr. Matsumoto told me Walter's still on the vow. Said he saw him 2 weeks ago looking fat and well. I was so happy that I almost kissed Mr. Matsumoto.
Did he say anything about Walter being transferred here?
I asked, but he didn't know. I'm just thankful he's alive. Walter and the other Americans were put on road gangs at first, but now he's interned with 300 other civilians. There's no running water, but Mr. Matsumoto said that they're alive.
Are they all Americans?
He didn't say, but mentioned about a third of them are planters, gold miners, and Del Monte people. So Walter must be with friends. That's a comfort. And I guess that's all he had to say.
You must be relieved.
I am. Mr. Matsumoto could hardly believe I hadn't heard a word about Walter since we were separated.
You're so brave, Peg.
Don't kid yourself. There isn't a day that goes by when I don't have a low moment and wonder if I can keep going.
June 2nd, 1943. Two overly curious guards invaded the ladies' toilet and baths, catching one of us with her bloomers down, causing much furor, and a complaint lodged at guardhouse by the women's committee. Inexplicably, at least to me, is parties are all the rage now. Jim wrote one of his best editorials about the complexities of throwing a party in an internment camp.
Camp Holmes Daily News. The principal intramural pleasure in camp is giving or being invited to parties. Almost any excuse is enough to find an occasion, but one must first consider who should you ask. The person who gave you an extra rotten banana at camp hay when you were hungry? Those who refrain from excessive argumentation on subjects theological, political, or otherwise? People who live far enough away in dorms to still be friends? Someone who works in the kitchen? Or Mrs. So-and-so because she has such good chow at her parties?
June 5th, 1943. The rain has been coming down in torrents for days, and Beatty got in a jam with another boy over a knife. The mother was naturally on the warpath and called Jerry. Beatty fibbed, as he usually does when he's up to his neck. The knife was eventually found by Beatty in his pocket. He'd been feeling very tough and devilish lately, but was sent to bed early under a cloud. Beatty hasn't gained a pound in the last 18 months. He needs eggs and milk, but we have none to give. Jerry's weight is down to 166, the first time since he was 17. He lost 9 pounds in 3 days in the last spell of sickness that wasn't even dysentery. I weigh 92 pounds, and my blood pressure is 88. I guess that we'll all just have to stick it until Roosevelt, Churchill, and the Marines come through. June, however, is blooming, full of pep, gaining weight, eats anything, yells her head off at baseball, and is well thought of in camp. She's learning the hazards of dating in the small quarters of a prison camp. Several nights ago, she played cards with one date while another one glowered. It's the other boy's turn this evening. June 19, 1943. Word of mouth tells news of a big American convoy in the Solomons near Guadalcanal. I found 50 cents and turned it in, but the owner was found. Oh well, there's nothing to spend money on, so no chance of me going on a wild fling. New rules concerning electric lights just posted, giving us a half hour extra on dark rainy days, with permission from a member of the executive committee. June 20, 1943. In the fried rice at supper was a measly 5 pounds of pork for 500 people. It was the first meat for days, so people whooped when they found a small piece on their plate. June 21st, 1943. We received a disturbing message from Nita's aunt, hastily scratched on paper.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Grauter, Nita had surgery this afternoon for her appendix. We got her there in time. I think she's going to be okay.
June 22nd, 1943. No further word about Nita, who is constantly on our minds. I would give many things to be with her now. June 23rd, 1943. One of the most pretentious couples in camp, who can't wash their own laundry and are broke,
threw a party for 90 guests on borrowed funds. Well, we have to hand it to them for the worst taste, the most asinine judgment, the most obvious play at politics, and the greatest lack of community spirit. Still, no word about Nita. June 24, 1943. June's been going through her own particular brand of hell this week. Three girls and one lad have ganged up against her, making withering cracks, write Spanish epithets on her school desk, and walk away or freeze conversations when she sits nearby. A desire for leadership and control is mixed up with it. The boy wants June to date only him. Ugh. They'll all get over it, but meanwhile, it is putting iron into June's constitution. No news about Nita today. June 25th, 1943. Finally, we heard word about Nita from Hazel, who saw her at the hospital in Baguio. The first bit of news mentally sank me to the floor, and the rest passed over me like a tidal wave.
Here you go, Natalie. Here's the bag of goodies Nita gave to me. Watch those eggs now. She said Ismael probably wasn't paying attention when he packed them for her.
Thank you. How is Nita?
She's in terrible condition, Natalie.
Did you get a chance to talk with a doctor or nurse?
All I got was she's very sick. Sorry. Oh, I almost forgot to give you this 10 peso bill she wanted you to have.
Oh, good. Thank you. So tell me, what did Nita say about...
Natalie, I think you're going to want to sit down when you hear what Nita told me.
Miss Hazel, I have horrible news about Crowther's home. The Japanese drove a big truck up to their house the day before yesterday and cleaned it out.
How awful!
They took everything but the piano and the stove. Ismael and our girls couldn't do anything to stop it.
Well, how could they?
They just stood and watched.
I know Natalie would say the most important thing is your family's safety. They weren't harmed in any way, were they?
No. Tell the Crowthers we're all okay.
Of course I will.
And please tell Mrs. Crowther that they didn't take anything we hid. Her ivories, her collection of Bibles, June and Bidi's baby books, and the family's silver are all safe.
Natalie will be so grateful to hear that, but right now she'd much rather hear you're getting better. You hear me, dear?
I'll be okay. Ismael said looters came later that night and took all of June's dresses except the three they dropped on their way out. I'm so sorry. The poor Crowthers.
Hazel said Nita was almost in tears because she couldn't send June a birthday package and felt worse about this than her physical pain. It breaks my heart. It is more than I can bear now. This pure love and unselfishness from a Filipina who is seriously ill, thinking only of us, worrying about our things and our comfort. I go down under it with roaring in my ears, bowed under the simplicity of being completely shorn, yet bestowed with the greatest and deepest gifts, and at the same moment, humble before Nita's affection, devotion, and selfless loyalty. She is our family, our sister, our mother. Her children are ours, and we are welded together now for all time. June cried over Nita and wants to spend all we have to make her well. Jerry swore softly, helplessly, going over out loud what we must do for Nita, if we could. Beatty put his head down on my lap, and I let him cry quietly until he raised his head and said,
God damn the Japs!
I told him the Japanese could not be blamed for Nita's illness. No one could. For the first time, I feel in prison. I want to fly to Nita to give her eggs, milk, and rest. Everything to make her well. And we can do nothing. Impetigo is spreading rapidly in camp. The salve spread over people's chins is so unappetizing. And is it ever going to stop raining?
June 26, 1943. I slept soundly, but woke as if I had not slept at all. As I cried through breakfast about our home being looted, June said,
"It'll be fun going home and starting all over with nothing."
She went on and on, planning with the spirit of youth, while I felt old, so old for the first time. It would have been all that June said. Exciting, joyous, fun working together. If only Nita was not seriously ill.
June 27, 1943. Dr. Hall told me today not to feel final or sad about Nita, as a typical gangrenous appendix is often called serious, but is not. My mind dwells fleetingly on possessions lost. Over second ground coffee, Jerry and I took inventory and talked about Beatty's recent behavior.
You know, since they stripped us of everything we own, I'm starting to agree with Jim. This war is personal.
What gets me is this wasn't, starving or even greedy locals. It was all planned and executed by officers.
Oh, but the Japanese are supposed to be the new order, the chosen people, the rising sun. I wonder which one of them's playing our Victrola records right now.
Oh, a lot of them came from Boston. Remember?
Yeah. 35 years of collecting 78s. Poof. Gone. And I'm gonna miss all of our books.
Remember hauling them down to Baguio from our first house?
Yeah, I sure do. Hey, speaking of books, why did Nita say she saved your Bibles?
I think it was her code word for my Indusco books.
You didn't toss them?
No, obviously not.
Natalie, if the Japanese are still interrogating missionaries for any association with the Chinese language school, what do you think they're going to do if they find documents and paperwork linking you to a political movement that advocates for China building its own industries?
Well, thank God Nita was smart enough to hide them.
She should burn them. If the Japanese find them, they'll haul us to jail and sooner or later start asking questions about my gas station. Remember how they kept questioning the missionaries last year about a mysterious oil man who'd done so much for China? I thought I was in for a damn good beating or worse.
But the Japanese gave up on that after Rufus Gray died.
Honey, when it comes to China, they're never gonna quit.
Maybe we can get word to Ismail to burn them.
Maybe.
Hey, have you given any thought about what we're gonna do about Beatty?
Yeah, his grudge about Nita and the house is getting ugly.
He's picked up that language from people in camp.
I suppose it's bound to happen.
No, it isn't. And he knows better.
Natalie, he's in a concentration camp. Even in normal circumstances, he's gonna hear all sorts of foul words out in the world.
Yes, but he's repeating them.
Yeah, I know. So I had a little talk with him.
Hi, Dad.
Hey, son.
What are you making?
Oh, I'm carving a new tray to replace the one stolen from home.
Goddamn Japs.
Don't let your mother hear you saying that.
I don't care.
Well, you'd better. You don't want to turn into a Japan hater.
Everyone else says it.
Not everyone. Not Carl or your mom and me.
But they took everything of ours, Daddy.
Not every Japanese. And they had nothing to do with Nita's appendicitis. You agree?
I suppose so.
Remember that guard who was an artist?
Yeah, he drew pictures of his village and kimonos for June.
Would you say the same thing to him?
No.
Why?
Because he was nice and drew pictures for us.
I never told you this, but before he left, He and the other soldiers told Dr. Dean that they had the best time of their lives in here. Think about that, BD. Doesn't it make you wonder what their lives have been like?
I guess so. But what about Lieutenant Mukibo and the guards who beat people?
Lieutenant Mukibo's a bad guy. He stole from us and he's in jail. The soldiers who beat people and the officers who tell them to do it'll join him when we win the war. Look, son, there are good and bad people of all stripes and nationalities. What I'm trying to say is, blame the right things. Don't storm at the wrong ones.
June 29, 1943. It looks like Lieutenant Kara is going to be around Camp Holmes for a while. We're not yet sure what his role is, but many are convinced that he's a spy. He's another interesting specimen to watch around here. Herb came by with Lieutenant Kara asking Jerry and me to play a round of bridge. Of course, we had little choice but to say yes to a strained, guarded game of bridge that turned into an unexpected, amazing and amusing evening, which my perverse brain thoroughly enjoyed.
Hey, Jerry, Natalie, are you up for a game of bridge with me and Lieutenant Kira here?
No, I've got an accounting class.
But
I don't mind skipping if we can get other players.
I'll play. Are you going to get another table?
Yeah. I'll go find some more couples.
I'll get the cards and some tea.
So, Lieutenant Kara, you play bridge?
Yes.
The tea Jerry's gone to get came from a tea taster friend in Formosa.
Then he must be good.
When did you last play a game of bridge, Lieutenant Kara?
3 years ago.
Oh, where was that?
Japan.
Do many people like bridge there?
No.
Well... we're so glad you'll be joining us, then.
Are we going to play rubber or duplicate bridge?
I don't know, Millie. You'll have to ask Herb.
Who's got the cards?
I do.
Okay. Betty and Jerry, you're at this table. Millie, Ted, you're with them.
You're going to pay a little more attention this time, Millie.
Now don't you start in on me, Ted.
Natalie, looks like Lieutenant Kira's your partner.
Well, then I have to warn you, Lieutenant Kira. I'm apt to be an erratic player at times.
Then may I say, Mrs. Cruda, I have absolutely no sense of humor.
Yes, you may, but it's really not necessary.
I'm gonna just head over to the other table then. Natalie, you behave yourself.
So, Lieutenant Kira, do you use the Culbertson system of bidding?
I don't know anything about it. I play very badly.
Oh, I have the feeling that you are being way too modest. Shall we get seated?
Two clubs.
Two diamonds.
Ted, it's your bid.
I soon found Lieutenant Kira's self-deprecation to be unfounded. He plays his hands perfectly, and knows bidding, plays an excellent game, in fact. When I drew his name as a partner, I felt cold steel across my throat. We had to watch everything we said. Jerry made frantic eye and mouth motions to Ted, who made a remark about not being able to tell Filipinos and Japanese apart. Ugh.
Lieutenant Kira politely ignored it. At one point in the game, I didn't hear Sylvia bid a heart, and when Lieutenant Kira bid two clubs, I took it for slam indication, and went two no-trump showing a bust, realizing something was wrong. After three no-trump, I left him in four clubs, and we went down six tricks. Oh, that cold, steely glare from across the table. But from then on, we got along fine. I didn't get my throat slit. And he does have a sense of humor, for he made slight responses to bridge table repartee and knows how to smile. Surprisingly, we weren't bad when we found our stride. 5 minutes before curfew, I said to Lieutenant Kira, "Wouldn't it be too bad if we found a slam just in time for lights out?" He grinned, and after the game, he said he'd like to play again. I laughed and promised to be well-behaved next time. And when I asked, "You like bridge very much, don't you?" he nodded, deprecatingly. Humbly polite, true to tradition. In the end, we wondered if he was trying to pick up information from conversations or just hungry for bridge and companionship. Both may be true. My sense is he's lonely, well-educated, and out of his element in this mess. July 1, 1943. Jim reported that last month we had 23.4 inches of rain. 5 more than average, and 10% of the year's precipitation, raining 25 days out of 30. July 2nd, 1943. Beatty rushed over to the women's dorm, calling me, carrying a bag from Nida.
Mom, Mom, Mom! We got a bag from Nida!
Really? Oh, she shouldn't be sending us anything.
Open it, Mom! Is there a note?
Let's see. There's cooking bananas, avocados, laundry soap, cigarettes, cookies, oh, and a bag of candles, and, no note. Oh, I'd give all these things just to know she's okay.
Well, she must be okay if she sent this stuff, right, Mom?
July 3rd, 1943. Miss McKim has been relieved of interpreting, as Lieutenant Kira has taken over this function, including all Japanese officers' visits, which means we'll now know even less about what's going on in camp. Our justice system is up and running, and June attended our first criminal trial, which was presided over by a judge appointed by the General Committee. It was a domestic dispute. June saw the victim just after the crime. She was covered with blood all over the front, holding her nose and being helped to the dispensary. The woman's face was swollen beyond recognition, black around the eyes, and she was nauseated all night. It seems earlier her devoted husband stood below a window, telling her that if she didn't do what he said, she'd be sorry. The next thing anyone knew, he was stalking up the stairs with a hammer in his hand and struck her twice in the middle of her face.
The trial was all over in about 10 minutes, Mummy.
Were there any witnesses?
No, just a judge and a court recorder.
What were the charges?
Entering a barracks without permission and assault and battery. He got a chance to make a statement, but didn't do it.
What's his sentence?
20 days in jail, 10 on a restricted diet.
What? But he struck his wife in the face with a hammer.
They're not sure what he hit her with.
Oh, how could they not know that? He could have killed her.
I don't get it either. The judge kind of acted like he didn't even want to punish him.
The man's sentence starts immediately. Except there is no jail because it's not yet ready. Isn't that a pip? We have a judicial code, our own camp gendarmes, a court, and no jail. Camp Holmes has become the other side of the looking glass, or a cruel social experiment, and our behavior is getting curiouser and curiouser.
people are going around quoting 1940 Time magazine articles that were written when our savings hadn't gone for naught, when we were living with our spouses and our homes hadn't been scattered to the four winds. Oh, it's a pity there isn't a degree in concentration camp sociology. We'd all have PhDs by now.
This concludes episode 16. Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.